and welcome to the New York Film Academy's final show of the season. It's very appropriate that Peter Rayner is back because we're doing a recap of 2017 in cinema. Stay tuned.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies.
Hey guys, you know that music. It's Star Wars weekend, and while you won't find any spoilers here, we're going to talk a little bit about what makes this movie special and why it's on our favorites of the year. Peter Rayner, of course, famous for Rayner on Film, his amazing book, which has maybe the best dedication to Marlon Brando you will ever read, is here, back with us in studio. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Joelle.
Hey!
We made it to the end of the year on these movies.
Just barely. Yeah. It has been a crazy year for cinema.
Yeah, it has been, yeah.
Just such a lackluster summer. Like, that, it lackluster almost doesn't quite define it. It's a terrible
year
money wise for summer.
Yeah.
To learning that in February you can release blockbuster material. Who knew?
It's strange. Of course, the weird thing about the whole year is that the scandals of Hollywood kind of overshadowed the movies of Hollywood.
It's true.
You know, I mean, that was kind of got top billing. And sometimes as a movie critic, I felt like I was, you know, covering the sideshow and not the main event. And some critics and commentators would sort of try to conflate the two and talk about, you know, Woody Allen movies in terms of psychobiography and all of this stuff, which I'm not too crazy about doing.
It's uncomfortable to diagnose someone you've never met. I find it weird when people do that.
Yeah, and also, I mean, theoretically, the pure in heart don't always make great movies, and there are some, quote, bad people who make great movies. But I do think that inhumane art is not art. And so, you know, ultimately, no matter who you are, if you're making something that's, you know, vile or racist or whatever, it's not art, it's not good. But, you know, that's a different discussion. But, I mean, this was a crazy year for movies because there was so many, you know, films coming out all the time that you quite... A lot of overrated movies, in my opinion.
Sure.
You know, I think people were looking for a buzz that wasn't there.
Lady Bird, maybe?
Yeah. Oh, you aren't a big fan of Lady Bird either.
Again, like, to me, it's not about not being a fan. Like, I like Lady Bird. I think it has everything a movie should have. Like, it checks all the boxes. It's well shot. It has good performances. It's a solid story with a lot of truth to it. But after that, I'm like, what are we celebrating here? Like, it's a good movie, but great movie, highest rated movie of all time. Very weird.
Yeah, yeah. I thought it was sort of like one of these Broadway hit shows that, you know, every button is pushed and everything works. It's a fine movie. It's fun. Mm-hmm. You know, the mother daughter relationship is good. It has more Catholic girl, you know, jokes and anecdotes than probably. But yeah, I mean, it's not a great movie. It's just a very enjoyable film, which is fine. Mm-hmm. But you know, that's sort of an example of the kind of movie that's been getting all kinds of. Call Me by Your Name is another movie that I think is perfectly fine, but not exactly a towering masterpiece.
People act like this is the romance to end all romances, and I'm like, again, quality film, beautifully shot, love the performances, but it's nothing that I have not seen before. It doesn't kind of bowl me over in its perfection, you know?
Yeah, I didn't think there was enough there, you know, even with the characters. I thought the performances were perfectly good. I don't think that, you know, Timothy Chalamet gives in any way the best performance of the year.
Yes.
There isn't enough stuff going on with both of those characters in terms of their life histories. Great villa. I'd love to spend time there and, you know, sip white wine. And,
it's beautiful.
It's beautifully shot. Shape of Water is another movie that even though I think parts of it are quite phenomenal, the fantastical parts are the wonderful parts. But then there's this whole Cold War melodrama thing that's very much a part of this movie that I think, you know, Del Toro is a great fantasist, a great imaginative visual filmmaker, but he also has a very pulpy side. You know, he's seen a jillion movies, many of which are referenced in Shape of Water, and rightly so, because he makes them his own. You know, Beauty and the Beast and Cocteau's film and others. But he also has this kind of pulpy side, and I think that's what sort of, you know,
won the day here.
Sort of. I mean,
definitely. You know. And the thing is, I understood the hoopla around Shape of Water. I'm like a super nerd, so I follow all of the like nerd sites, the trends, and what was exciting about this is, of course, Del Toro's previous work.
it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
In Hellboy, you know, people want to draw correlations between characters. They want to, as we're building out universes in cinema, there was a lot of buzz around that kind of idea of, like, is this going to be a new universe, that like a Del Toro-centered universe, which would have been fun and exciting. Right. And then even to the point of, like, he brought together a really great kind of unconventional cast together. Unconventional just in that I would not have expected to see these actors necessarily working together in a film, especially during this era. But long term, yeah, you know, it again, fun, a little weird at times. Bizarre sex scenes, which, you know, take or leave.
Yeah, E.T. With sex.
It's just very
creature
strange.
From the Black Lagoon, you know. But those are the scenes I like those scenes because they were like really nothing else. And I like Sally Hawkins. I think she's
phenomenal.
Really good in this film. But you know what? She's equally good or better in a movie that just kind of slipped away this year called Maudie.
Oh, I don't know.
Where she plays
film.
This outsider artist, a real person, with Ethan Hawke. And she's sort of a hobbled, woman who is very recessive. It's an amazing performance. And both of these performances are really extraordinary in the same year. But unfortunately, Shape of Water is getting all of the attention, from her, which I suppose if you're voting makes sense, because if you vote for these awards, you have to vote for the picture and not for the actress, for the picture and not the actress. So,
yeah.
You want to split your vote with the...
That kind of reminds me of, like, Naomi when she did Blue Velvet, which was great and critically acclaimed at the time, but did not do great circulation-wise. And then she came out with The Ring just a couple years. People were like, oh, my God, she's born overnight. It's like, where have you been? Yeah.
No, I know. It's a shame. But nevertheless... she's been in, a bunch of Mike Leigh movies, and she was terrific in those films. She's not a conventional type movie star. Mm-hmm. So I hope that this helps. She would have been great in the silent era, especially when you see, Shape of Water and Maudie. I mean, she does so much of her acting with her eyes.
I was going to say, she's got the eyes for the silent era. Yeah. Nice and big. Keeping on the kind of more traditional Hollywood cinema, let's talk a little bit about The Post, Steven Spielberg's latest movie, of course, starring Meryl Streep. What did you think of The Post? Why did that make your list?
Well, it didn't make my 10 best list. I like The Post. I don't think, it's a very conventional movie. I think Spielberg can direct these movies blindfolded. You know, he just knows how to make everything click and fall into place and move. And he directed it very quickly. The film was put into production specifically to be released this year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the script was only completed like a little over a year ago, I think. And
this is like Wonder Woman timing on here.
Yeah, that's crazy. Because he wanted it to speak to the zeitgeist, about freedom of the press, about, women, overcoming male privilege and corporate, all of those things were very, that are so current now.
Super timely.
And that's why he very much, is on the record as saying that's why they rushed this through. It doesn't feel rushed as a movie. It feels like, it was very well organized. I don't think there's anything startlingly original about it as a newspaper film. I wouldn't rank it up there with All the President's Men or even Spotlight. The co-writer of Spotlight is the co-writer of this film.
Oh, okay.
But the... performances by Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep are quite good. Hanks it's a different take on Ben Bradley from what we remember Jason Robards and All the President's Men, but he's very convincing. And Streep is Kay Graham, the first woman publisher of a major newspaper who finally gave the go-ahead to publish the Pentagon Papers, which is the crux of the movie, against all odds. She's wonderful, as usual. Her makeup for me would look, I don't know, a little Mandarin or something. I thought it was a little off-putting the way they made her up. But I think, you know, she gives a very touching and real performance.
Was she made not to be beautiful, or is it?
I don't know. I think they didn't want her to look like Meryl Streep, so they did something to make her look less like who she is.
Copy.
But I don't think they really needed to do that. Mm. But she's awfully good in it. I do, having said that, I kind of hope she stops playing famous ladies or real people for a while. You know, Julia Child, Maggie Thatcher.
Yeah.
I mean, you get
that
to a
opera
point.
Opera lady.
Yeah, right. I mean, not as well known, but yeah. Florence Foster Jenkins.
There we go.
Which is a movie I really loved, and I'm sort of in the minority on that.
Yeah, people hated it. I'm like, it's a fun movie. Come on.
I know.
They
really hated it.
The union of Hanks and Streep is kind of like De Niro and Al Pacino in Heat for me. Like, two great actors that we haven't seen do scenes together,
right.
Coming together to do, you know, a Spielberg movie, right. No less.
Like Frankenstein meets the Wolfman.
Yeah, and I purposely haven't done too much research on this film yet, just because I like... If in my ideal world, I would see every movie at a festival with just no information beforehand and just get to experience it. Right. Are they on the same side of things, or are they at odds with each other in the movie?
You mean...
Hanks and Streep.
As characters in the
Yeah,
film.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, they're sort of... You know, they're at odds, but underneath it, there's a respect and love.
Oh, okay. It's one of those. All
you
right.
know, but it's not sappy. There's a scene early on before the Watergate thing happens where, you know, the Post is sort of trying to be a big newspaper. And at that point, they're really sort of more of a regional paper in the shadow of the New York Times. And they're being kept out of coverage of Trisha Nixon's wedding because Nixon doesn't like the Washington Post
wow.
style page. You know, he thinks they're too nasty. So Streep and Hanks have a breakfast, and she says, well, maybe we are a little too nasty. And and Bradley, you know, is the editor of the paper, says, you know, get your finger out of my eye. and you know, the way he says it is kind of not entirely a joke, but it's you know, they're very good together. It's very good teamwork.
So it looks like also not quite making the top 10, but definitely in you know, honorable mentions, 13 billboards or three billboards.
Well, that's another one I thought was overrated. I mean, my actual top 10 is very eccentric and weird. And
it is. It's very diverse.
Yeah, I mean, it is. Three billboards, I thought, had the virtue of never going where you thought it was going to go, you know, so it gets points for unpredictability. But I didn't think in the end that it didn't really work for me. The Frances McDormand is very good in a very rather one-note role. I thought, you know, she's sort of indomitable and vengeful
and
angry.
People say this is the most honest role they've ever seen, like shoo-in for Oscars.
Yeah. yeah. I thought the best performance in the movie was Woody Harrelson, who plays a police chief that she goes after and who's sick. And it's a wonderful performance. He also plays LBJ in LBJ this year, which no one seems to have bothered to check out. And except for him, it's not really that great. But he's a wonderful actor, and I think he's for me gave the best performance in Three Billboards. Overall, it sort of struck me as being kind of second tier Kenneth Lonergan kind of stuff. You know that
strong words.
You know, I mean, he's also a sort of Irish or Irish American playwright, and he's very good with dialogue and so forth. But I don't know, there were just sort of too many roads not taken, and the roads that were taken, I thought, were not always that believable.
Mm-hmm. The last one on your honorable mentions list is the new Star Wars movie, The Last Jedi, which we will not do spoilers here, guys. I know for me, in my review, I wasn't ready to put it at my number one Star Wars film of all time, but I definitely think it outdid The Force Awakens. I love the story. I love what Rian Johnson was able to do with those characters. What was the standout moment for you in the film?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very enjoyable, and standout moment. I don't know. I thought Mark Hamill was really good in it.
My goodness.
You know, I mean, he gives a really good performance. And I can't say too much because I'll start giving things away.
Yeah, no, we don't want to do any spoilers.
But I do think that it, you know, he put some real soulfulness into it where he probably didn't even need to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of like The Perils of Pauline. I mean, there's a cliffhanger every 15 minutes. And
it's true.
Adam Driver is about as broody as – he's like, has he ever played Hamlet?
He probably needs to, though. I really liked what they were able to do with Kylo. Writing-wise, again, we won't do any spoilers, but I thought they gave a lot of validity to that character. Before, you're like, this is just a crazy, like, child acting out. They gave him some backbone and a structure to build off of.
Yeah.
And the repeating scene worked really well for me structurally.
Yeah.
So, fun film.
Yeah. It. You know, I think for me the best is Empire Strikes Back. I think most people, you know, pretty great. But this film references that quite a bit. And I guess there's another one left in the trilogy, and then Rian Johnson's going to do another trilogy after that.
Well, JJ's going to do the final one in this trilogy.
Right. But then after that, I think he's going to do three more.
It'll be interesting to see where he takes that and they're not following the Skywalker family. I am not
a Star Wars nut like some people are. So I didn't find that. I mean, this is not a religious experience for me, this film.
It was.
But I know you are. But it worked for me even so. So it'll work for the four other people out there who are not Star Wars nuts.
I look forward to hearing this. And seeing it early, the thing I've been waiting on most is just to get other people's reactions to it. So I'm looking forward to it. Let's get into your top 10. I'm going to start with my least favorite of your top 10, which is Mother. What did you like about Mother? How does it make it in there?
I'm going to get a lot of heat for this. I mean, people didn't just dislike this movie. They hated this movie. I mean, you know, Rex Reed said, it's not just the worst movie of the year, it's the worst movie of the century.
I thought that was excessive.
Yeah.
But
I you know, yes, it goes way off the deep end the last 15 minutes. And I normally don't like Darren Aronofsky movies, so I feel doubly weird for liking this film, you know, because all the people who like this movie. I just thought, I don't think it's like a Rosemary's Baby kind of thing, which a lot of people are. I think it's about, it's sort of his mea culpa for being a prima donna, shall we say.
Sure.
I mean, the Javier Bardem character is a sort of diva, you know, self-infatuated poet, and Jennifer Lawrence is kind of his wife slash muse, and he puts through all this horrible stuff. And to me, it was kind of a movie about, you know, just how reprehensible the artistic personality can be, you know, how hard to live with.
Okay, I can see that.
You know?
The whole time I just felt like I wish he would have done this, just gotten a story credit and handed it over to a woman to be like, maybe we flesh this world out a little bit more, explore less surfacey issues with women. Like, it just felt like feminism 101, and that there wasn't a lot of depth behind the surface. I was intrigued by a lot of the performances, and anything that's like weird and kind of avant-garde, I'm instantly going to gravitate towards. So it was an intriguing experience watching the film, but I don't know if it cracks my top 10.
I know. Well, you speak for millions.
Let's see.
But it was number 10, so I didn't.
Right, yeah, right.
Okay, it's not. Yeah, okay.
That's totally fair. Number 9
10
is.
10.5.
Peter. Number 9 is The Breadwinner, which is an animated film that's been making the circuit. For me, it's my favorite animated film since maybe The Secret of Kells.
She worked on that also.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. For you, what was it about the story in The Breadwinner that gets it onto your list?
Well, I think it's just a really touching, powerful story that has all sorts of ramifications, both, you know, personally and politically. Now, you know, this girl tries to save her family from the Taliban in Kabul, and I know a lot of people think that animation should just be for, you know, fun games kind of stuff or goofy stuff, and that you can't deal with serious issues in animation, but it's been proven time and again that you can.
Marjan Stropi did it with her book Persepolis, which was turned into an animated feature. I never understood that theory of like, oh, well, suddenly it's a drawing and so it can't be emotionally impactful.
I don't know. I guess, you know, people grow up with you know, Disney or whatever, you know.
And Bugs Bunny, for sure.
You know, I mean, and you don't think that you can speak to something serious using animation because it's basically a kid's genre. The nice thing about the Breadwinner is that I think it works for kids and for adults, too. You can interpret it on many levels. And, you know, it's very, very beautifully animated, and, you know, the voice work is good. I think Angelina Jolie is involved.
Yeah.
No, she had
a
production credit on it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. She, by the way, directed a very interesting film, you know.
I've heard interesting things about that movie. A lot of controversy about the way they went about casting it.
First They Killed My Father. It's a very strong film, you know, set during the Khmer Rouge massacres. But yeah, I think Breadwinner is just a, you know, marvelous, marvelous movie.
I encourage people to see it if you can in your hometown. I'm sure it'll be available on Amazon Prime soon.
Yeah.
If it's not already. Let's take a look at number 8, Ex Libris. What is this?
Ex Libris is a 3.5-hour Fred Wiseman documentary. Now, Fred Wiseman to me is God. Okay. Mm. He's 87, I think, now. And he makes a movie a year since, you know, the 60s. And almost all of them are first rate. This is about the New York Public Library. And what he does, he tends to make movies about institutions of some kind, social institutions, political institutions, you know, Neiman Marcus. You know, he's been all over the place. And he spent, you know, many months filming not only the main branch of the New York Public Library, but the many branches around the city. He does have a tendency to go in a little bit too much for board meetings, you know. I mean, sometimes you feel like you're trapped in a cable access, you know, town hall tape loop. But it's just a very powerful movie. It's a movie about, it's sort of an ode to not only New York and the many people who inhabit these libraries and work there, which is an incredible cross-section of people of all kinds. But it's also sort of an ode to the freedom that is engendered by these libraries, which is, if you think about it, a very important thing right now in the world.
It's totally fascinating. Yeah. You have writers and musicians like Neil Gaiman and Amanda Palmer doing these really elaborate setups at the New York Library trying to help raise funds. People of New York, a very popular Facebook page, now Coffee Table Book, they had a huge thing where they were going around collecting the stories of librarians at the New York Library. So incredibly timely.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of that stuff in the movie. The weird thing is that you very rarely see in the film an actual hard copy book. You know, libraries have become so much more, you know, than that. I mean, everything is digitized. There's concerts, there's planning sessions, there's political rallies, there's, you know, first responders to, you know, try to encourage people to sign up, and all of these things going on in at least in this constellation of libraries. And it's just fascinating. And there's even, you know, very funny little asides, like this, you know, someone who's answering the phones, the library, and he goes, no, ma'am, actually, a unicorn is not a real animal.
Oh, no.
You know, it's like...
I really want to watch this now.
Yeah, it's 3.5 hours, but you know what? So what? I mean, that's actually fairly short for a Wiseman.
Wow, okay.
But it's a terrific film. Yeah, I mean, he always shows his films on PBS. Until fairly recently, the only way you could see his movies was either by catching them on PBS or you know, renting them at exorbitant prices from his company in Cambridge, Mass. But then he's been putting his films on DVD, and I don't know if they're streaming or anything, but you can definitely access them in other ways besides seeing them in theaters at this point. And he got last year the Governor's Award from the Academy for his life work, because shockingly he was never nominated for an Oscar for Best Documentary.
Wow.
Which is totally shocking. And I mean, because for me, he has the greatest body of work of any living American filmmaker.
It's a huge body of work every
year. Yeah,
it's
over
year.
40 films, and wow. Some of them are just absolute mass domestic violence, hospital, Law and Order. You know, I could go on and on. I mean, they're just great, great movies. Juvenile Court, Welfare.
Do you think Ex Libris will get some kind of award consideration? Do you think people will be talking about it?
I mean, it's the problem is that when you have a film that's that long, mm-hmm. it tends not to get the kind of votes it should get because not enough people have seen it. Right. But it did very well in the critics awards polling. I don't think Faces Places, I think, won most of the time in the major critic groups. But it you know, he doesn't need those kind of awards so much anymore, but it always helps.
Definitely. It seems like it'll be a very strange year for awards as well. I don't want to deviate too much from the list, but yeah. I know the New York Film Critics, was it Society or Circle?
Circle.
Thank you. They voted for, like, Moonlight with Best Director.
Last year.
Yeah.
New York Critics voted for La La Land for Best Picture.
And then was it Best Director then?
Moonlight was Best Director.
Okay.
But in L.A., I believe it was Moonlight that was Best Picture.
Yeah, and then this year they did Get Out, but we noticed that the Golden Globes did not pick up Jordan Peele as Best Director. A lot of people were looking to Greta Gerwig to maybe get some nominations this year. That didn't happen at the Golden Globes. I have a feeling that by the time Oscars comes out, it's going to be an entirely different set, which will be very weird. Typically, they are pretty much aligned.
Well, there's no consensus this year, which can be kind of interesting. And, you know,
it's
these
refreshing.
People who make their living handicapping the Oscars, you know, starting January 1st, you know, with all these flow charts and stuff. I mean, it's all kind of nonsense. And afterwards, when everybody's wrong, they don't really go back and say, oops, they just kind of move
nonsense.
On to next year.
There's no harm in guessing.
I'm not particularly good at predicting Oscars. People think, oh, you're a film critic, I'm going to find out what you... But no, I mean, film critics often outsmart themselves. The big trap you fall into when you're handicapping Oscars is to pick films that you like as opposed to the ones you think will win.
Truth.
You know, I mean, it's very tempting to put a film that you really like in there. Oh, this is going to win Best Picture, when you know that some film you hate is much more likely to win.
I lost my 2012 Oscar poll because I chose How to Train Your Dragon over Toy Story 3 for Best Animated Picture because it moved me. They should have known Toy Story was going to win. Tell us a little bit about Kitty. That's another film that hasn't been, you know, high in circulation.
I know, yeah. It's a documentary about cats in Istanbul. But it's a wonderful movie. The way it works in Istanbul is for thousands of years, apparently, the city's been overrun with cats because they're considered, I don't know, good luck charms. But, you know, they just kind of let them run free. And so the film is shot sort of from cats' point of view a lot of the time, focuses on three or four of these cats and all the troubles that they get into. But more than that, it's a movie about the city itself and the people who inhabit it. Who love these cats, and it ends up being this kind of rhapsodic portrait of a great city through the eyes of these cats. It's hard to describe, but it's a wonderful movie.
I've heard nothing but really great things from the people who've seen it. They're like, it's funny, it's charming, and it's a really interesting way to explore a city that many people haven't had an opportunity to
exactly.
visit.
Exactly. And I'm not a big cat person either, you know. That's not why I really like this film. If you are a cat person, then it's probably like the Star Wars of cat films, right?
I'm surprised YouTube hasn't gotten a hold of it yet, and it kind of seems perfect for them. Here's a movie I haven't seen yet, but I'm dying to see, The Phantom Thread, which is rumored to be Daniel Day-Lewis's final film.
I know.
How are you feeling about it? Is this a good note for him to leave on?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's a very good movie, and it's a terrific performance, but that's all the more reason why he shouldn't be leaving. I think he's a little bit nutty, perhaps,
yes.
Shall we say. But the fact that perhaps the greatest actor in movies who's won three Oscars and could possibly win a fourth for this is just going to sort of hang it up. He's not that old.
Mm.
Why? I don't get it. I mean, he said he sort of fell out of favor with himself when he made this movie. It was too sad an experience. I don't get it.
He talked a lot about filming in a very small house because the shop where they worked, so that's where they filmed.
I don't know. You know, he's married to Rebecca Miller, who's a film director, the daughter of Arthur Miller. So I'm hoping that at some point...
She'll write something for him.
Well, she'll need money. You know, she'll need somebody to step in and make the financing for this film, and he'll do it. I mean, he has been in films of hers before.
Wasn't My Left Foot her film?
No, that was Jim Sheridan.
Okay.
Yeah, that was wow, what a performance that was.
Yeah, it was really great.
But you know, he he's kind of done this before unofficially. He doesn't act that much. There's 3 or 4 years between movies. And one time he sort of took off entirely and worked as a cobbler in Italy. You know, he has, it comes from one side of his family were cobblers, you know. So, but this is the first time he has sort of said publicly that he's not acting anymore. But, you know, Sinatra said he wasn't going to perform anymore, and then he came back, and, you know,
I mean,
Jimmy Cagney.
Miyazaki has, like, retired 3 times in the last, like, 5 or 6
years.
Yeah,
I mean, so. I'm hoping there's some role that's just so great that he can't possibly turn it down. But he plays a 1950s English dressmaker in this mm-hmm. movie. Not a real person, but it's sort of a composite of several people, I think, who with his sister is, you know, is part of this company that he owns that, and it's... It's a strange movie because it's really more like Rebecca or Vertigo,
really,
than anything else. Yeah, that's not how they're promoting it.
It's kind
of a freaky movie in good ways.
I wonder if they're trying to get Amazon had a series set in the same time period with the same kind of backstory of like people who survived the war and now they're making these very elaborate garments, which had the feel of the trailers. It's like a romance and right. then very pretty clothing. I loved it. It was very much up right. my alley. Right. So it's interesting to see if this is more like Vertigo, murder mystery kind of psychological thriller.
Well, when you see it, yeah. And in fact, because I was thinking all that while I saw the movie, and then there was a Q&A after the screening I was at with the director, Paul Thomas Anderson, who also wrote it, and he brought up those films. I mean, it's pretty clear that's the direction he was going in.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Let's talk about a film that was on almost everyone's favorite list, The Big Sick, which is based off the real-life events of a couple who meet, fall in love, and then the woman just becomes tragically ill. And then it's a struggle, you know, dealing with her family and trying to keep romance alive when dealing with terminal illness, which turned out not to be terminal in the end. What stuck for you with The Big Sick? What makes this different than, you know, other pictures that came out this year?
Well, I think it's very funny. It's very well written. It has tremendous acting by the whole cast, including, you know, Ray Romano, who's an underrated actor, and Holly Hunter. You know, it's just very, very well acted, with some depth to the performances. And it's a culture clash movie. Mm. You know, he's a Muslim, I think Pakistani immigrant who can't even tell his parents that he's dating a white girl, and that, you know, so it touches a lot of nerves in terms of that kind of cultural collision. But it's funny and it's sad and it's not a great movie. You know, in some ways it's like Lady Bird. You know, it sort of punches all the right buttons and it's very slick. But it does have heart to it, and I think particularly with his story, what he goes through to have his parents sort of accept what he's doing. They don't even like the fact that he's a stand-up comic. You know, he drives Uber, you know, to make a living, and then all of this other stuff happens. I wasn't surprised that it's based on a real relationship because it does seem, you know, fairly true and authentic in the way it comes across.
Definitely. I'd love to talk more about The Big Sick, but we're running on time. I want to make sure we hit every film. Your next one, which we talked about before, I hadn't seen, you filled me in. Agnes Varda is still making movies. What?
Yeah.
And this one is called Faces Places, and it's basically her and her camera running around France talking to artists and just people out in the streets. She's just so legendary to me, and I really adore her. I cannot wait to see this film. What stuck with you about Faces Places? Like, what?
Well, it's such an idiosyncratic, one-of-a-kind, handmade movie, which is particularly in her documentaries is what she does. You know, if you remember The Gleaners and I, you know, she does these films where she sort of discovers the movie as she makes it.
Mm-hmm.
And she teamed up with this I don't know what you'd call him exactly. He, the guy named JR, he's in his 30s and she's 89. And they sort of form this twosome where they travel the French countryside. He takes these pictures of the villagers as they travel around in this large truck that has a developing room in it and everything. So he takes pictures of people, and then he somehow blows these photos up and plasters them on the sides of buildings and walls.
Like a Banksy.
Yeah, like you know, some woman lives in a house that she doesn't want to vacate or something. So they put this big face, you know, photo face of her on the front of the building. It's very weird, but also just the intimations of mortality and friendship and everything else that goes on in this movie, the discussions that they have, the relationship that they create as they're going through, you know, and you're discovering these people who are very open to the camera and they talk about their own lives. It's a wonderful movie. At the end, she supposedly is going to meet up with Jean-Luc Godard, who, you know, she knows from the old days. She was actually one of the originators of the French New Wave in the early 60s. And, well, he doesn't show up. And it's a very sad moment. You know, I mean, he's as ornery as they come.
Yeah.
So it's not entirely. But the way that's resolved and how she finally kind of works it out with this guy JR, and they it's hard to describe, but it's a wonderful, wonderful movie.
I love Agnes's approach to film. It's very we're talking a little about before the show started. It's just very feminine in how she approaches it. It's not at all as you were describing, pre-planned. It's very kind of floaty and almost more poetic.
There's nothing coercive, and she doesn't, you know, like I said, she discovers her film in the process of making it, and obviously in the editing room, but you don't get the feeling in this movie that, you know, there was a playbook of any kind. Mm-hmm. And that's what's so wonderful about it. Just tangentially, I just realized it's funny that a number of the best films that I've liked this year were made by people well into their 80s. I don't think it's on that list, but Andre Vida's last movie before he died, After Image, is a terrific film about an avant-garde artist during a communist repression in Poland. He was 90 when he died. He made the film shortly before that. Fred Wiseman is 87. Varda is 89. So you can make terrific movies as a you know, octogenarian.
Everybody
folks
has something to say.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the Florida Project briefly. Willem Dafoe getting a lot of Oscar buzz himself for this.
Yeah,
apparently breakout child star actors. I enjoyed the film, but it's, again, with our punch card, hits a lot of ticks, but didn't do a lot for me. What was it doing for you? Because it's like number two on your list.
Yeah, I would say maybe one. Yeah, I mean, it's I really, I don't know, this movie just struck me the right way. I think that it has a kind of free-form, poetic aspect to it that, you know, the comprehension of childhood that's in this movie is, I think, on par with some of the best of the Truffaut films, like Small Change. Dafoe is great. You know, he's often good, but I think this is his most human scaled performance. Mm-hmm. There are no prosthetics or anything going on there. He's playing a sort of bedraggled motel manager in this rundown motel outside of Disney World, where mostly single mothers or grandmothers and their children are there. Brooklyn Prince, who's the child star of the film, I think she's six or seven.
Yeah,
she's had some theatrical experience, I gather, but. Boy, is she a terrific performer.
She's a firecracker.
Dynamite. I mean, it's really good. And, you know, so I think it just really struck me as a kind of, you know, poetic, you know, reverie of childhood in a way that I hadn't seen very much in an American film.
This feels, this is also another film like The Phantom Thread that was shot on location. So this is an active hotel where people are living. And Dafoe in his Hollywood Roundtable talks about how important it was to be surrounded by the people, and it was easier to become one of them instead of just talking about their story, you know, actively living it, which I think definitely shows up on film.
Yeah, and the film was shot in 35, I believe, and his last film was shot on iPhones. So, you know, he's versatile.
He's willing to experiment.
Yeah.
Speaking of versatile, my favorite film, I'll gather your number two then, is Get Out, which came out of nowhere and slapped me in the face. I've never been more afraid of teacups in my entire life. The idea of visualizing pain in a way that is a black box. It was so inventive and I think probably as visceral as 2001 A Space Odyssey the first time you see it. And then, of course, just this new talent on the screen, Jordan. And from this, of course, he'll have his he's going to do a Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, after this, you got to think, like, yeah, what better mind could there possibly be to do it? What was different about Get Out for you?
I just thought it was such an original movie. It was like a mashup of all of these types of films, of genres that normally just don't go together. It was a horror film. It was a comedy. It was a, you know, very bracing, you know, socially conscious film, satire. All of these things that were put in together, and it all works. It's a very daring thing to do for any director, let alone a first-time writer-director. And I couldn't believe as the film went on what I was watching. I said, is this really as good as I think it is? You know, is this going to sort of devolve into, you know, a kind of zombie movie? Mm-hmm. And but no, I mean, it really, it with all of the films that have been coming out and all the discussion about race relations in this country, to me, this is the movie that speaks most clearly to the paranoia and the unrest that is behind a lot of this.
And I think in a hyper-intelligent way, I've seen so often, again, just very surface explorations of racism in America. And this is such a deep dive into what it's like to experience racism, how people can be both aware and unaware of their traits. It's a fascinating film and super fun to watch, even in your second or third
viewing. Yeah, I mean, it's great to watch with an audience. It's not the best way to see this movie, you know, at home, you know, streaming it or something. You know, you really, it's one of those movies you really need to see with a full house because you know, everybody screams in the right places and they're really with it. There's an electricity in the audience that I hadn't experienced in most films that I've seen this year.
And watching it, I felt it must be like the first time people saw Planet of the Apes. Just in...
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah. I mean, there's a sense of discovery and also a discovery of a wonderful new talent, you know, at least as a film director.
Yeah.
But
even the lead actor, whose name I can never pronounce, it's got a lot of A's and W's, but he's now going on to be in Black Panther, and I know he's got another big movie deal
right,
after
yeah,
that.
He's from England, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's and Brian Williams' daughter is in it, you know.
yeah, Allison.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a really, really good movie, and you know, I always like, for me, the best combination is scary-funny. So, you know, like Jaws was scary, yeah, funny, you know, that, I mean, I think that's a wonderful combination, you know, if and when it works. So I think this film is really the breakout. Get Out is the breakout movie of the year. And I hope that it does well. I'm not a big Oscar person, but I hope it does well there for a lot of obvious reasons.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think that movies like that normally get awards because they're considered, you know, horror films or sure, something. But I think we're past all of that. And it really is, it's more, it feels realer, more, you know, to have a film that have all these different tones going on it about that subject than other films, you know, even films like Detroit and some other films that came out this year.
Well, heavy-handed.
You know, I mean, they sort of show you what happened in its way, but this film, I think, really shows you from the inside out how it feels, you know, and it also doesn't pull any punches with, you know, the white liberal establishment. I mean, that's really one of the targets of this movie. You know, the hypocrisy that is so much a part of racism. So I just, it's a wonderful film.
I really enjoyed it too. I enjoyed going through your top 10 list today too, Peter. That was a lot of fun. Thank you guys so much for joining us. We really appreciate you being here. In the links below, tell us what your favorite movies of the year were. Do you agree? Do you disagree? Do you have some input?
Mother.
Okay, maybe. But we definitely want to hear from you. This is our last show of the year, but we will be back in January. So just follow the Popcorn Talk Twitter page and you'll get an update on our exact date we'll be coming back. But thank you so much for joining us this year. It's been a lot of fun. Thank you, Peter, for coming in.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Joelle.
Educating us. It was wonderful. Sure. And we'll see you guys next year.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.